This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it's the 21st of November, 2009. Today I'm talking with Steve Lindman, who is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca, and he's the co-host of the Global Research NewsHour on RBN, Mondays to Fridays at 10 a.m. Central Time. He also runs a blog at sjlindman.blogspot.com, where he writes on political, economic, and social justice issues. And Mr. Lindman, it's an honor to have you on the Corbett Report today. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, James, it's my pleasure and my honor to be on with you.
Excellent. Well,
a key subject to talk about, no
absolutely,
question.
A very key subject. But it is your first time here on the Corbett Report, so why don't we get to know you a little bit? Tell us about yourself and your background.
Well, very simply, before we began recording, I mentioned what I'm doing now was a complete accident. I never planned it. Most of my working life, I was part of a small family business. I retired at the end of 1999 at age 65. I didn't particularly want to do the things most retirees do, fishing or golf or tennis or whatever. I started reading voluminously, and I'll surprise you, I never had a home computer until less than 5 years ago. I never touched one in my business. The people who know how to run them did just fine, so why should I get in their way? And I just wanted the stuff that we needed computers to produce for us. I didn't want to become a computer expert and have to crank it out myself. My daughter finally convinced me to get one, and that's what literally changed my life. Again, by accident, I became a writer, and I've always been a bit outspoken on the major issues, and I might express it verbally in conversations with family or friends, and once in a while in one of our management meetings in our company, where I would diverge from the topic at hand and make some comment about those horrible people in Washington. They're mucking up everything, and then name names and policies, and my brother would look at me and say something like, "Well, you know, some of the people sitting here might disagree with you." Well, my feeling is, well, let them speak up and speak their mind.
Well said,
And occasionally I'd write letters to friends or whatever. I didn't have a computer, so I'd write letters. I'd handwrite them. And occasionally they got very long on things that were going on that concerned me greatly. Maybe that was kind of an initial thing that made it a little easier to say, gee, I've got a computer, I'm going to say something. And I began by accident, and one article led to another. And I never dreamed I'd be doing now. I never had an interview until May of 2006. And the first time I was asked on one of my articles, I almost turned it down thinking, what do I know? I might end up making a fool of myself. But I checked out the host on her website, and she looked friendly. And it was out of town. it was on a St. Louis radio station, and I said, "Well, if I mess this up, at least I'll do it out of town, so nobody in Chicago will know about it." And it went great. After a couple of minutes, I was nervous at the beginning. Then I settled right into it, and when it was done, I looked forward to more. And again, I never dreamed that I'd end up hosting my own program. And I've been doing that for almost 3 years now. And I began slowly on that. I like to say that I began with mere mortals like myself, a couple of friends who I knew, web editors, and we had lovely chats. And then I began going after more and more people, distinguished people. And the way I feel now is I'd be happy bringing anybody on. I'll engage anybody in the discussion of major events. But the only people I don't want, James, I think the people you don't want, they're the ones we go after in what we have to say and what we write.
Well, that's right. It's interesting to hear your background story there, because it connects with mine, and I'm sure probably many of the listeners in so many ways, including, of course, the way the internet was really a game changer, and I think has really changed the political paradigm that we're living in, and the social paradigm, and the way that that our society is structured in so many ways, and one of those ways is that it's activating people who never considered themselves as writers or experts or authorities. authorities are suddenly becoming activated in ways. And one example is me starting this podcast. Another example might be you with your articles. So it's a very exciting time in so many ways. And that's, I think, the hopeful thing about it. So how did you come to be part of the Global Research NewsHour? And how did that connection start for you?
When I began writing, at the very beginning, I had no idea who to send articles out to. So I sent them to maybe two or three or four web editors. I sent them maybe overambitiously to some magazine editors that you can reach online, like The Nation magazine, The Progressive. I think there were a couple of others. Never got one of those to bite. And for me, it was all volunteer. I never wanted anybody to pay me. So take a look at what I'm doing. If you're interested, go publish it if you wish, and that's fine. One thing led to another, and I began discovering more websites. So I wanted to see who can I send my articles to. Global Research was one. And it just was one among a growing number of others, and they began to pick up my articles. So I was delighted. I didn't really know much about Global Research, except it seemed like an awfully fine site with awfully good material on it, which is true. And of course, there are others that are excellent as well. I mean, compared to the stuff that you get in your morning newspaper, or the right-wing magazines, the Times, or the Newsweeks, ones like that. My God, I mean, they're just a lot of good websites that publish wonderful material. And now I'll send, when I write an article, I'll send it out to a bunch of them. But I'm very heartened that others who I don't specifically send an article to will discover something I wrote, and they'll pick it up and repost it. And I never go back weeks later to see just how far something I wrote got all over the internet. But I've glanced occasionally, maybe 4 or 5 days after I put something out, and I'm just astonished at how many sites will pick something up. And it'll include websites, it'll include blogs, and it's terrific. The internet is a godsend, James, and honest to goodness is. And at the same time, I worry that the dark forces that we take on all the time realize just how potent the internet can be. So on the one hand, we have a battle for net neutrality. I just wrote about it, and I've written about it before many months ago. And on the other side, you've got you've got the government, and you've got the big telecom companies and cable companies that absolutely want to control this internet. Not only to have it a source of added revenue, turn it into a toll road, and charge extra for anything in particular that you pay no more for now. They want to milk every dollar they can out of it, and at the same time control content so people like you and me are not free to say what we want to say. Right now, James, we're the media. We're the real media. We're the media that really tells it the way it is and the way it should be told. And the other guys, who unfortunately reach the millions and we reach the handfuls compared to them, they get the big audience. We have to do the best we can. But we're gaining. And again, the only thing I fear is that as we gain more, we may be much bigger targets. So we need to be very watchful about that. That scares me greatly. It really does.
Well, absolutely. I concur wholeheartedly with that assessment, because there's no doubt that we are really in fundamental ways starting to overtake and really change the political paradigm through independent reporting in a way that I think was never possible in previous generations. And there's no doubt that, unfortunately, I think as our power grows, so will the eyes and the awareness of the oligarchs who you and I are fighting against, you know, every day with the things that we're confronting. So that's a topic that we've come back to again and again and again on the Corbett Report, and we'll continue to do so, because it is one of the fundamental topics, I guess, of the entire political paradigm that we're living in. But it certainly was the Global Research site through which I encountered your articles, and it was with great interest that I read your November 11th article, which was Suspected Hemorrhagic Pneumonia Outbreak Hits Ukraine. And this is really kind of a compendium article of all of the information that was publicly available about the new Ukraine viral outbreak, at least as it was on November 11th. And I'd really like to recommend people read it for themselves. But Mr. Lindman, why don't you start breaking down that article for us and tell us about some of the information that you uncovered there?
Oh, absolutely. Let's be informal, James. Steve is what I go for. When somebody calls me Mr. Lindman, I turn around to see if they're talking about my father. But he hasn't been around for over 40 years, so I know that's not the case.
All right. Okay. Steve, tell
us
about your article.
What I did. I never dreamed that I would write about Ukraine. I hadn't planned on doing it. And a fellow who I know with an affiliation with things that I've written about Venezuela, occasionally he'll email me, and he sent me a startling email asking me, are you aware what's going on in Ukraine right now? And he just mentioned a couple of quick facts, and I emailed him back, and I said, he added in his email, he said, you've got to write about this. And I emailed him back, and I said, I really don't know anything about what's going on in Ukraine. And in the back of my mind, I said, well, I hadn't planned to write anything about Ukraine. And then he emailed me again. I think it was the next day he emailed me, and he gave me more information, just the stuff that was known at that point and the startling stuff that ended up in more extreme numbers in my article. And I said to him, look, I'll do what I always do. I'll research this thing and see how much I can find. And if I can get enough, I'll write an article. So that's what I did, like what I do for all articles. I just started researching, doing a thorough Google search, and looking for everything I could find. I know I didn't find everything, but just find as much as I could. I found plenty. And as you say, a compendium. I put it all in an article as I knew it up to the time that I put it out. And it was pretty shocking stuff. You know, we have to speculate on exactly what's going on, but I have the worst fears. I suspect very strongly that this has got nothing to do with ordinary flu. Very likely we're talking about something on the in the category of a bioweapon, that this outbreak did happen, that it did not happen by chance, that it was planned, and I have to wonder why Ukraine and not somewhere else. I've got a couple of thoughts on that. Apparently, it's quite a serious thing in Ukraine and getting worse. And an article was sent me overnight from Prison Planet, dated yesterday. The writer. I don't see a name on who wrote this. I'm looking at the top. Maybe there's a name on the bottom. But it's talking about the title of this article is Unconfirmed Reports of Large Numbers of Deaths from the Vaccine in the Ukraine. Well, I absolutely believe that the vaccines that people are being told to take for swine flu are not traditional vaccines, all of which anyway are toxic, dangerous, and should be avoided. There is no such thing as a safe vaccine. I've discussed it on my program, including with the world's foremost vaccine expert, who was absolutely unequivocal and said, you've got to stay away from all vaccines. They are all dangerous, and they often cause the diseases they're designed to prevent. And she's written the definitive book on the subject. Her name is Vera Scheibner. She lives in Australia. She came on at 3 in the morning, James, on my program. And I've got her scheduled to come back again on the 30th of November to talk about more, including the connection between what you and I call HIV, which she calls SIV, simian, monkey-related. And she says it's caused by, we need to discuss this, she gave me a one-liner in an email, but caused by the vaccines people take for polio. And this is how, she says, people come up with what we call HIV. Well, I need a better explanation than that, more detail, but we'll get it on my program and more about vaccines. And I'll ask her for her reaction to what's happening in Ukraine. She doesn't have any inside information. She researches known research, known medical papers, and she's in the process now of researching literally 100,000 pages of medical documents, because she wants to update her book to make it as current as possible. But anyway, I pulled together all of this information, and it's frightening, including reports in a number of Ukraine cities of aerial spraying, and not one or two reports, but I read one or two articles that said there were hundreds of reports of people calling into newspapers, editors, maybe radio stations in cities reporting this. I wondered if the hundreds sounded exaggerated. I forget the word I used. I think I might have said many reports in my article. But what I actually read was that hundreds of people were calling in and reporting this, not just in Kiev, the capital, but in other cities around the country. So apparently there is extremely widespread illness in Ukraine. I was looking for a definitive answer on just what is this thing. What does the best scientific proof say this thing is? The best I could come up with was to call it hemorrhagic pneumonia. And apparently, autopsies on some people are showing, autopsies of people who died, obviously, were showing that their lungs were black, that this was something absolutely devastatingly lethal, and maybe hemorrhagic pneumonia is exactly what it is. Before we get into the issue of people taking vaccines and what is that doing to them, that's not what I covered in my article, but this stuff, I think, coming out on that now, relating what's happening in Ukraine and in other countries, spreading to other countries in the region that I covered briefly in my article, spreading to Russia, to Bulgaria, to Bosnia. I don't think I mentioned Norway in my article, but there have been reports about some large outbreaks in Norway, stuff going on in Canada now. My God, when will it hit the U.S.? And what will hit the U.S. exactly? But things relating what's happening in Ukraine, possibly to toxic vaccines. Well, the president of Ukraine, I don't know if he's mandated vaccines yet, but it sounded like when I wrote my article, he was right on the cusp of mandating vaccines for everybody. And Ukrainians, before this outbreak happened in October, were shunning vaccines. So Ukrainians are getting the word, just like other people around the world, that there's a lot of information out on these vaccines being toxic and dangerous. You want to stay away from them. So all across Europe, people are staying away from these vaccines. And that I did have in my article. And even in the U.S., half or more of the population wants nothing to do with these vaccines. I wrote earlier, James, on vaccines alone, I've written around half a dozen articles on them. And my thought at the outset was that they will be mandated. I honest to God believe that was the plan. It still may be the plan, but I think because of the public opposition, the authorities are very hesitant because they don't want an uprising. They don't want crowds in the streets in every city saying, you're not sticking that needle in my arm. We've already read the reports. We're reading all the stuff about what's happening to people. I suspect there are growing reports of deaths in Western countries, in the U.S. and Canada, and I suspect that this has nothing to do with swine flu. This has everything to do, if the reports are true, and I have to wonder, but let's say they're true, then they're true because of people took a toxic vaccine that killed them. Now, Ukraine, I think, is something different, and it may be, again, we're talking about some kind of an unleashed strain. Maybe it's a mutant strain. It caused this terrible, devastating effect in Ukraine that, as of my article, got over 1 million Ukrainians sick, something like 55,000, or it might have been up to 65,000 hospitalized, and hundreds had been killed, low numbers of hundreds killed. I forget my exact number. Oh, it might have been 174 or 175, but I know the numbers have risen. But now the numbers in things that I'm reading are rising, people dying. And this article on Prison Planet, November 20th, oh my God, it's talking about thousands of bodies in the street and reports are being covered up. But the article does say this is unconfirmed. So we don't really know what's happening today, right now, in Ukraine. But it sounds very ugly, and it sounds like whatever is happening is getting worse. It's spreading to other countries, and it may be fast heading for the U.S. It may already be here in some form, maybe not the Ukraine form, James, but maybe something is going on that is making people in the U.S. as well as other countries ill, and we will begin to see rising numbers of deaths. Now, maybe this is the scheme. Kill off some people, scare others enough to go take this toxic vaccines, and then heaven help the people who take them. I didn't pause for ear almost in that, but let me let you jump in.
Well, absolutely. Well, you touched on several of the key points there. In fact, most of the points that I want to raise in this discussion today. But one of the points that you raised there is the idea of reporting and the lack of reporting on the subject, or reliable reports that we can say definitively this or that happened in the Ukraine. And that's something that's really concerned me over this story, is that there are so few reports coming out about this remarkable new strain of the disease, or perhaps it's a different disease altogether, the H1N1 or whatever it is that's happening in the Ukraine, and the media silence on this new strain or new outbreak is particularly perplexing, because there was such hype that greeted every new instance of or outbreak of H1N1 as it was spreading across the globe in the spring, and of course as they're ramping up for flu season in the States, it became a big story again. But if, for some reason, in the Ukraine, there was almost nothing coming out about this, even though there were these reports of these really horrible effects of whatever this new viral outbreak was. So that was particularly perplexing to me. And now, apparently, 4 days ago, the WHO declared that this is just the regular AH1N1 strain. It's not a mutation. So if the WHO is to be believed, then this is, in fact, not a new strain. But and now the consensus in the controlled corporate media, for example, the Washington Post today is reporting that the Ukraine situation might just be hype and for political reasons. And the suggestion in the Washington Post op-ed that I'm looking at is that this might have been done for the benefit of certain drug companies, with politicians hailing shipments of Tamiflu into the country as if it's going to be the savior. So again, we come back to the question of are there economic motives behind hyping up these types of outbreaks? And but to me, one of the fundamental issues is the reporting on this, or the lack of reporting. So that's particularly frustrating, especially in a situation where there's that language barrier. And certainly myself, and I'm sure many of the listeners out there are unable to access local Ukrainian media without using translation tools or something. So that prevents us from having sort of direct access to the information. So as we're waiting for the controlled corporate media to report on it or tell us what to think about this thing, we have to piece it together for ourselves, which is a lot of work. So I'm my hat's off to you for having compiled so much information on this. But what's your take on that, on the lack of media reporting on this, and now the fact that the WHO is apparently trying to tell us this is just regular influenza?
Oh, I agree. I think it's very disturbing that the media pretty much is staying away from saying anything about this. As far as the WHO goes, there is absolutely no question, James. The WHO is a criminal organization. They're staffed with a lot of high-level drug industry types. The profit motive is very central in what's going on. If they can get enough people to take the swine flu vaccines, although vaccines as a profit center overall, all vaccines, it is a major profit center for the drug companies, but I guess everybody doesn't take them all, obviously. And if they get enough people around the world to take these swine flu vaccines, we're talking about an enormous amount of money, many, many billions of dollars. I saw a number in Business Week, but I have no idea how they came up with it. I saw the number $400 billion over a number of years, but then I saw $10 a shot. And I said, well, how do you get $400 billion from $10 a shot? How many billions of people do you need to vaccinate to come up with that kind? Maybe they're talking about multiple shots. I don't know. But in any event, we're talking about an enormous amount of money for the drug companies. I think another issue in Ukraine The political situation, I think, is an issue, but it's not the central one for me. I think some people may think it's quite central, but this president Yushchenko, he's an unpopular guy. He's also got an election coming up, I think, in January. So one theory is that he sprung this thing so he could postpone or cancel the elections. Well, you can't cancel them forever, and if you get enough people sick, the people will blame it on you. I mean, what have you done, or what haven't you done to protect us from this kind of thing going on? But it's very possible that he's got a political motive behind this in some way. But I think it's a lot more than that, because it's spreading to other countries. And one thought I have, it's only a thought, there is no question that the two prime targets, I think the U.S. is involved in whatever is going on, because nothing big happens around the world if Washington doesn't sign off on it. I think that's a given. So something like this, if this was manufactured, and I believe it was in Ukraine, then I think there had to have been approval from Washington to go ahead and do it. So why Ukraine? One answer is it borders on Russia. And the two main targets for the U.S. are China economically and Russia militarily. We're encircling both countries with military bases. So, I mean, one way, you can't nuclear bomb Russia, because they'll do the same thing back to you. But what about infecting a large percent of the population with this awful stuff that's happening in Ukraine? It's spreading across the border. The Russian health authorities are very concerned about it. So maybe that's a motive. Look for there's an outbreak in China as well. Maybe that's a motive to go after China in some way. So I think that could be possibly part of what's going on. But and another major issue that I've written about in a couple of my articles, the motive of depopulation. I absolutely believe Ukraine, the swine flu vaccines. I absolutely believe. The first thought I had in my mind, James, when I began writing about the swine flu vaccines, were I saw three motives behind wanting the government to have everybody take this toxic stuff. Number one, we've got two seemed obvious to me, the profits for the drug companies. I mean, they'll make a mint on this. The second thing that seemed obvious was we have a major economic crisis going on. Forget about the positive reports. There are millions and millions and millions of people in this country that are suffering dismally, and job losses are still in big, big numbers, home foreclosures, savings just lost, people living in fear that, my God, Monday morning they'll get a pink slip. So we've got this terrible stuff going on, and all the salvation for Wall Street is not transferred over to Main Street. So you want to divert people's attention from an economic crisis? Give them a health crisis. So that was number two. And the third one was depopulation. And this goes back many, many decades, including to what I quoted from a secret Henry Kissinger memorandum. You know, the NSSM
200,
right? Yeah. 1974, I believe. Well, it goes back further than that. I mean, the Rockefellers have wanted depopulation decades before Kissinger. But Kissinger wanted to depopulate on the order of something like 500 million people. And I think his idea was to do it by involuntary sterilizations. Well, that could be behind this. Also, toxic vaccines that will kill people, not the same day they take the vaccine. Maybe they'll get sick with some lethal disease a year later, 2 years, 5 years later, unable to connect it to the vaccine. So I think those three motives are behind what's going on, both the vaccines, both what's going on in Ukraine. And I see it as a very ugly situation. I know the people in the power structure think there are too many people in the world. There are billions too many people in the world. We can be far better off if we cut the population maybe in half, maybe get rid of a few billion people. And one of the phrases used is to call these people useless eaters. They're using up resources that the power people want to sell and make a profit for. They don't want these useless people having access to these resources. So what do you do about it? Wars are too slow and messy. infect them with some kind of an illness, kill them off that way. And we'll just chalk it up to, oh, my goodness, what a shame. So many people got sick. We warned you about it. We told you to take this vaccine. Now they're dying off like flies. It could make the 1918 scale look like a picnic if this thing is as bad as some people and maybe myself fear it could turn out to be. I mean, we could be talking about numbers that are beyond imagination.
Well, that's exactly right, and it's so important what you just brought up there with the idea of depopulation as something that the oligarchs have been lusting after for decades, if not generations. And an article that I always tend to point people to in that regard came out in June of this year from Paul Joseph Watson of PrisonPlanet.com. It's called "The Population Reduction Agenda for Dummies," and it is an incredible article that has numerous references to all sorts of things like Kissinger's NSSM 200 and all sorts of videos and documents and things talking about this agenda that has been unfolding literally for decades and has been funded from the very top, from some of the, you know, the elite oligarchs like the Rockefellers and many others. So that's a key article for people to look at in that regards, and something we've talked about on the Corbett Report many times. But I'd like to go back to something that you were saying earlier about the idea that perhaps unleashing some sort of new strain in the Ukraine on purpose could be used as a military strategy as part of the encirclement of Russia, which is a fascinating idea because it touches on something that goes back to a famous document, the Rebuilding America's Defenses document that was released by the Project for a New American Century in September of 2000 and contained that now famous or infamous phrase about the process of transformation absent some catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor would not be able to take place. And of course, the new Pearl Harbor came on September 11th, 2001. But what that document talks about is ways that the military could transform for the 21st century. And one of the things that is specifically mentioned in that document, which once again is signed off by people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Jeb Bush and other key American players in this system, is that the idea of race-specific bioweapons is an idea that must be made politically viable. That's one of those bone-chilling quotes that you really must have to read for yourself to see and understand in its staggering implications. But we start to come into the idea of bioweapons and race-specific bioweapons even as a form of warfare. So I think we should touch on this subject and how this type of idea has propagated down through decades, and of course goes into the very upper echelons of the U.S. military, and has a very interesting history on its own. But why don't we talk a little bit about that idea of using a biological agent as a tool of warfare?
Oh, I think that what a tool of warfare, James. You know, I did not know about that quote in the Project for a New American Century document, and I've sure quoted that a few times in the past, not recently. That is a bone-chilling quote, but why not? Again, wars are messy. They're expensive. You simply, no matter how big a war or maybe how many numbers of smaller ones you may wage around the world, you simply can't kill off enough people with wars. My goodness, I mean, take the biggest wars that we ever fought. I mean, we just didn't kill off enough people. What, World War II? What, 40, 60 million, whatever the number was. I've seen all different numbers. I mean that's chump change compared to what these guys are talking about. A race-specific bioweapon. Well, I guess it can be race-specific, James, by just unleashing it in the parts of the world that you want to really hit hard, or maybe in the neighborhoods that you want to hit hard. If you do it by vaccines, well, I don't know how you keep it from spreading to other, maybe neighborhoods is not such a good idea. I mean,
maybe
if some people get sick and they sneeze on you.
Exactly.
I mean, they're going to get you sick.
Exactly. You can't spread it in your own area. Well, no, but the idea of race-specific bioweapons is actually something that there has been research into, and there is some indication that the Israelis have been working on and potentially have such weapons. And we know that with new research into genotypes and things, that this is something that's very much on the table now. And we really are living in Buck Rogers these days, and things that seem like science fiction are actually happening at the moment at the sort of cutting edge of science. But I guess even barring the race-specific element of it, certainly the idea of using biological agents as a tool of warfare is something that goes back a long, long time, thousands of years even, when plague victims would be sent into the cities of people that you were waging war against in order to try to infect the population and that sort of thing. So certainly the idea has been there since warfare began. But of course, it's becoming more sophisticated now. And I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their head around this subject, and because it is something that's just so vast. But you have an excellent example of that in your article on the Ukraine, and that was an incident that happened with some Baxter flu virus vaccines in April of this year. So why don't you tell people a little bit about that incident?
Well, that was Jane Burgemeister, who's been on my program a couple of times, and she sued Baxter Labs. They did something that should have been impossible to do. They sent to other labs a large quantity of vaccines, of substances that were dangerous, and they control their production very, very carefully. I think they do their research, their work. I believe it's called a BLS Level 3 laboratory that has all kinds of controls built into it. Expert people who work there who simply would not allow a major problem like what happened, in fact, be able to happen, but it did. And Jane believes, and I agree with her, there's only one way that Baxter ever could have done this. It was not an accident. They deliberately unleashed toxic material, and they sent it out to other locations. And she sued them, and she sued others. That was an April suit. She did a second suit against top officials in countries, including in the U.S., organizations like the WHO, the UN, the WHO, CDC, I believe, that this is part of a malicious attempt to deliver into the environment toxic substances that will cause the kind of harm that we're seeing in Ukraine and would cause mass outbreaks of disease, and that this is not something that happened by accident, which is the way Baxter described it. They sloughed it off as an accident. Well, I guess if you take something to court, Jane's suit was dismissed, by the way. No surprise. She sued in Austria. The April suit was in Austria, and she sued the FBI. I don't know where she filed that suit. That was a second suit. I think it was in June. The Austrian government dismissed her suit. Well, no surprise. The other one will be dismissed as well. And even if you get this thing into court, maybe proving intent is not the easiest thing in the world to do. That something happened that maybe was, one in a thousand chance or one in a hundred thousand chance. Well, I guess the law can say, well, amazing things happen. The unimaginable actually happened, and statistically it's possible. So who can prove intent? But I absolutely believe that this is intent, that Baxter is involved. They got their patents for their drugs a couple of years or more in advance of when we started to hear about a so-called swine flu threat. I guess the other companies were doing exactly the same thing. There is no question in my mind, James, that what is going on now was planned well, well back, many months ago, maybe a number of years ago, and they picked a moment to unleash it. I don't think it's happenstance that they picked a time during an economic crisis. And again, goes back to my idea of diverting people's attention from their economic woes to worry about whether they're going to stay alive or not. So they picked their timing on stuff very, very well. And what do we say about all this? You could wrap it up by saying, government is not our friend. Government is our enemy. They are conspiratorially allied with the drug companies in this. the same thing on other issues, war and peace and so on. But on this, the drug companies and government, the U.S. and other governments, Western ones primarily, are involved with the drug companies to conduct this campaign to cause great harm to possibly as many as billions of people around the world, and maybe this will unfold over many months ahead. I'm surprised that it's been slow in coming out now. I thought we'd be in full bloom by the time the kids went back to school, and we'd be seeing round-the-clock media hype on, my God, this thing is really spreading, it's dangerous, you got to get this vaccine. And I think just the public outrage and fear about maybe what we're being told ain't the way it really is, I think that slowed them down. But I think the plan very much is on the track and moving forward. And they want to get this thing out, and they want to get it in full bloom for the goal that they have in mind. And if it takes them so many months longer, so be it. So my guess is we'll see this thing maybe raging as we get into next year. And heaven help us all if we don't stand up and resist. I mean, I say unequivocally, and I've had a number of programs on this with a few people, saying we absolutely positively have to not take a swine flu vaccine. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. But I quoted a lawyer who was an expert in one of my articles on vaccines, a guy named Phillips, Alan Phillips, I believe. I wrote an article called Vaccination Myths and Truths, and I quoted him. He put together some wonderful material, including, how can we legally avoid taking a vaccine? In theory, or actually in fact, the law protects us, but when the government wants to, we can sweep aside the law in a national emergency. So the law will not protect us, international or U.S. law. The one safe thing that people can do, let's put it this way, the safest thing people can do is get a medical exemption based on a past bad drug reaction with anything, based on an allergy, based on anything you want to get your doctor to tell him, to write you an exemption saying that you should be exempted because of a potential harmful reaction to a vaccine if you take it. That is the best defense. I absolutely wanted to get this on the program, James, because I think that's important. We should all fear that the state we live in will mandate that we take a vaccine. This is the best way to hopefully avoid it. I think the way the law really works is the WHO does not have authority over any nation. It can come down with a ruling. And I think the way it would work in nations is the nations would go along with what they say. But if the nation will not go along, the WHO has no power to force them. In the U.S., the states are sovereign. Technically, the U.S. can mandate something, and one or more states can refuse to go along with it. In fact, I don't think there's a chance that will happen. If the government comes down with a mandated ruling, because of a national emergency it declares, and Obama has already declared a national emergency on this. At the same time, there have been several dozen others declared over other things in the past few decades with no grave consequences. This could be the exception. This could be a national emergency that could lead to a national mandate that there's a fear that the tens of millions could be infected with a lethal disease. It will gravely harm the country, harm national security. So the government is ordering mandated vaccinations. There will not be one of the 50 states that will not go along with this. And every single city will go along with it. So what can we do? The only thing I know is a medical exemption, which I think is important for people to think about.
It absolutely is. It's vital that people do resist what's going on right now, because it's a sobering thought, but perhaps the best that we can hope for in this situation is that the swine flu scare that's going on right now is actually going to be a dud, not the real bioweapon attack, and it's only being used to set up the infrastructure for medical martial law to that they can use for future attacks. So if that's the best that we can hope for in this case, then what we have to do at this point is to try to discredit that infrastructure for medical martial law that they're trying to set up right now, and absolutely and thoroughly negate it and repudiate it while we still have the ability to, before the real bioweapon attack hits, if this is not indeed it. So
it's absolutely one key point I want to add.
Please.
If enough people stand up and say no, we are the ultimate superpower. There is absolutely no question about that. Their best way to get us to go along with what they want is to keep us disorganized, confused, so on and so forth, uninformed, you know, the usual things that they want to do. But if enough of us get informed about what we think is going on, are fearful enough, and think our government is lying to us, we absolutely stand up and refuse to do it. I mean, we'll be in the streets if we have to, refusing, then they are absolutely helpless against us, and that's what we have to do. We have to keep spreading the word about this thing. We have to tell people that if you want to stay healthy, you have to understand your government is lying to you. They want to harm you, not help you, and you absolutely positively have to say, no, no way, we will not do it, and there's nothing that you're going to do to make us do it. They will back down if enough of us do that.
That's exactly right, and in fact, that's exactly what has so far happened in the fact that the swine flu shots did not get mandated, at least not yet, and that, I think, speaks to the power of the alternative media in getting the word out about this and discrediting it and starting that mass protest and movement against the mass vaccinations. So what we're doing here is just one small part of it, but it's an important part nonetheless, and I encourage everyone who's listening to our voices right now to get involved and in any way they can, even if that's simply passing this information along to someone else. Every single bit helps in this struggle that we're waging right now. So, Steve Lenman, for the people who are out there interested in following your articles and your reporting, what's the best way for them to find your work?
Well, it seems to end up in a lot of places on the internet, James, and I do keep a blog. The easiest way to see everything I've done, I set up a blog way back, not to be a blogger, but just to store all my articles in chronological order from the first one. So if anybody is curious what I began doing and wants to just take a peek at all the things I've written about, there are quite a lot of articles there. I'm quite surprised. My blog site is sjlendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, .blogspot.com, and you can go back and you can take a peek at all the things I've written about that I began back in the summer of 2005 when I wrote the first one accidentally. And I'm not certain if the chronology is quite right at the beginning, because I set up the blog some months after, maybe a few months, 3, 4, 5 months after I began. And then I went back and I added the articles that weren't on in the first place. So the initial months might not be exactly in chronological order, but very shortly thereafter, certainly beginning in 2006, everything is in chronological order, and they can see what I've been up to all this time. And I seem to stay very active, James. I'm 75 years old, and I honest to God say this energizes me. It keeps me young, and I put in long hours every day on this. And at the end of the day, what stops me, and I just have to stop and do something else, is my eyes get tired. Maybe I guess that could affect anybody if you stay online long enough. But my eyes get tired, and then I just have to get offline and do something else. But I can put in a very long day and keep at this thing, and everything that comes up during the day, except an interview like this, is a diversion. Eating is a diversion. It's a distraction. But you got to eat.
Exactly. Well, I know that feeling very much. And in fact, it's I'm a Canadian citizen living in Japan. So right now it's 1 a.m. for me. And
My goodness, I didn't know that. You're in Japan.
Yeah, I tend to stay up very late every night working on this as well, because it's really the most important thing that I can be doing with my life right now. So it's what I'm attempting to do is spread this information, and I think that's what motivates both you and me and many, many other people out there. So it's something that we have to continue doing, and I'm Mr. Lenman, I'm sorry, Steve Lenman. It was great talking to you today, and I'd like to thank you for being here.
Oh, It's my honor and a great delight to be with you, James. And I'll just end with one more thing. I never became one of the super rich of the world, and that's putting it mild. That's putting it lightly, mildly. So call it what you will. But I feel blessed. I mean, I could have ended up someplace with a war raging around me, or terrible poverty, and I never went through any of that. So I say to myself as a motivation for what I do, this is my time of life to give back, and that's what I'm doing. And the reward that I get is absolutely priceless. You cannot put a price tag on what I do. So that motivates me to keep going. And wonderful people like you, James, who pick up on what I'm doing and ask me to come on and spend time on air with you, this just energizes me to want to go out and keep doing this. And I think you feel exactly the same way.
I certainly do. Well, let's leave it on that positive note. Steve Lindman, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, James. Happy to do it anytime.